Good day. Today is Sunday, 22nd February 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel if once you've watched this programme or whichever part of this programme you want to watch, you decide you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate this fact. Now, I'm going to begin this programme, but again, by briefly returning to the situation in the Middle East. We have had no decision yet by the President of the United States, by Donald Trump, apparently, to attack Iran. There were no strikes against Iran yesterday, but there is a rather concerning piece of information, which is that it appears that the president was intending to come to travel to attend the Winter Olympics. He was going to go to Europe to attend the Winter Olympics. He called the trip off at the last moment. He's decided to stay in Washington, and apparently one of the people he's seeing is the head of the Air Force. And the speculation is that the head of the Air Force is trying to persuade him, or is in effect telling the president, that it is now, either an attack on Iran happens now, or it has to be delayed until mid-March because of the issues of the moon, the issues of the lighting at night, which I discussed yesterday. After tonight, the moon comes out in the Middle East. That makes it easier for the Iranians to observe the movements of American missiles and American aircraft. That makes those missiles and aircraft more vulnerable to interception. The US prefers always to conduct in nights where there is no moon. Tonight is one. That has been true for the last couple of nights. But after tonight, the moon comes out and we will have situations, conditions, nighttime conditions, which are not regarded by the US military as optimal for conducting military operations until the middle of March. So it seems that the president is receiving this advice. He's receiving this advice from his military. The military are trying to push him, perhaps, into an attack now, on the assumption that a decision to conduct the attack has already been made. But there are also continued reports that the president's civilian advisers are trying to get him to understand that an attack on Iran at this time would be extremely unwise politically, that it might very easily backfire disastrously on the president, that if the attack fails, if Iran comes through, if the United States finds itself in a long war, if there are large numbers of American casualties, then his presidency, in effect, is destroyed. His political future has ended and his ability to get decisions through the government will have come to an end. So the president is caught between these two forces. And of course, he also has to contend with the extremely radical and hardline voices also within amongst the civilians, not just within his administration, but in the United States government or political system, who are also urgently demanding an attack on Iran, who are probably telling the president that Iran is weak, that it will easily collapse, that this is his great opportunity to achieve a great and famous victory and to secure his legacy and to establish himself as one of America's greatest presidents, and who are ridiculing any suggestion that Iran is in any position to respond or to withstand the kind of blow that the American military has prepared. And, well, we know the name of some of these people. The US ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, has given an absolutely extraordinary interview to Tucker Carlson, in which, based on a biblical reference, he appeared to say that, he actually said that Israel has a perfect right to occupy and control vast areas of territory of the Middle East, even beyond those territories that Israel currently controls. The ambassador said that he had no problem with that. This caused absolute fury across the Middle East and in the Islamic world. The Arab League has published a ferocious statement in response, strongly criticizing what Huckabee said. All of the big Arab states signed it, including Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, Qatar, all of them, even though getting all of these countries at times to work together is like herding cats. Apparently, the Islamic states, the wider Islamic world, is also outraged. Ambassador Huckabee has now, to some extent, though as far as I can see, without any real appearance of conviction, walked back on some of what he said. But I don't think that in the Middle East, in the Arab world, in Iran, there's any doubt that he did mean what he said, and that he speaks for a lot of people in Washington. And I was absolutely incredulous to read another interview, this time given by that most consistent hardliner of all, Senator Lindsey Graham, Senator of South Carolina. He almost boasted that he visits Israel twice a month and spends a huge amount of his time there and seems to be very happy, much more happy being in Israel than, as some people, for example, one of his constituents writing in the American Conservative has pointed out, much more happy being in Israel than he is in his own state, which is South Carolina, which perhaps is not the best impression to give in the run-up to the midterms, when I understand that Senator Graham comes up for re-election. Anyway, I'm not going to dwell on Senator Graham's movements. It appears to me that his belligerence, his consistent support for Israel, all of that has been a regular reality of American politics for all the 30 years that he has been in Congress. So there's nothing, to my mind, especially new there. All I would say is that Graham himself does seem to be under some stress. He apparently had a massive row with Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen of Denmark, presumably on the issue of Greenland. I'm not sure why Senator Graham wants to get involved in the Greenland affair either, but presumably he feels it's important in order to stay on good terms with Donald Trump. Anyway, the fact that he got into this row suggests to me that he's stressed and nervous, though, of course, he continues to demand, he continues to insist, in fact, that an attack on Iran must happen. And one gets the sense that with Senator Graham, the sooner it happens, the better. And he seems perhaps increasingly frustrated that the attack has not been heard, happened already. So the president, as I said, remains subject to contradictory pressures. I get the sense that his heart absolutely is with those who want to attack Iran. His head, however, if that's the right word, tells him that this is politically very risky. He's probably listening to those of his advisors who are telling him that this is a huge mistake. He's nervous, he's dithering, he doesn't quite know what to do. And the problem with this president, as I've said many times, is that he doesn't like to appear weak. He doesn't want to seem to find himself in a situation where people call him a coward, which, by the way, if he doesn't attack Iran, some people will. On that, by the way, they are completely wrong. It is a decision not to attack Iran, given the realities of American politics and the dominance of the neocons in the media. It is that decision which requires strength and courage. But I have to say, confronted with demands from an Air Force general, there is a real possibility that the president might indeed authorize an attack on Iran, and it might happen tonight. If it doesn't happen tonight, I agree the prospects for a delay grow. It will more likely happen in mid-March, though the timetable there is difficult because, as I pointed out yesterday, the president is supposed to be travelling to China at the end of March to meet Xi Jinping, and an operation against Iran that lasts just 2 weeks seems to me to be unlikely from everything I've heard about the situation. Anyway, the president is also very busy trying to get his tariff policy sorted out. Yesterday, he said that he would impose a flat tariff on all countries of 10% after a very strange post on Truth Social. He decided that he'd increase the tariff to 15%, which means that many, many of the countries that he's negotiated deals with are going to be paying a higher tariff now than they were before the Supreme Court decision. I wonder where this all leaves India, by the way. The Indians supposedly have made concessions to get tariffs reduced. Well, 15% is less than the tariffs they were paying before. But anyway, it looks like they'd have got that one way or the other, even if they'd never come to any kind of agreement with Donald Trump. Anyway, I'm not going to dwell on this now. It's a topic for another programme. It's hugely embarrassing for the president. It might affect his economic policy. I've had a very, very alarming, I've been on the receipt of a very alarming email from Dr. Jack Rasmus, which encloses, attaches his latest article about the economic situation in the United States. In it, Dr. Rasmus says that there's a very high chance of a financial crisis in the United States this year. And Dr. Rasmus says that if there is such a crisis, it is likely to be more broad-based, involving more financial markets than the financial crisis of 2008, and that the United States is in a much weaker position to respond and deal with the effects of that crisis than it was in 2008, because the budget deficit is far bigger and the overall debt levels are much greater. Well, I'm not going to analyse that now, just as I'm not going to talk about tariff policy. I found it a worrying article. I've tracked Dr. Rasmus over many years. I tend to find that his predictions, if I can say it frankly, well, they tend to come true. Anyway, let's move on and let's return to the perennial topic of these programmes, which is the conflict in Ukraine. Now, yesterday I talked about the meeting of the Security Council in Moscow. To be clear, this is the Russian Security Council, and the fact that it was chaired by Putin, as Security Council meetings in Moscow always are, and the fact that Medinsky and Kostyakov attended this meeting. And reports across the Russian media confirm that Medinsky and Kostyakov did indeed provide a report to the Security Council about the meeting which took place in Geneva on Wednesday. And they did indeed receive instructions for the follow-up meeting with the Ukrainians and the Americans, wherever that is going to be. Witkoff predictably has said that he expects that at some point in the next few weeks there will be good news. But then Witkoff has been talking about good news in relation to these negotiations ever since he first went to Moscow around a year ago. And we see that no substantive progress up to now has been made at all. And Dmitriev, for his part, the man who runs the economic part of the negotiations, which are purely bilateral between the United States and Russia, Dmitriev has also been sort of talking things up, though with less of with less confidence, as far as I can see, than Witkoff is. And Dmitriev also criticizes the Europeans and the Ukrainians for their obstruction of the talks and of the way in which the Ukrainians and the Europeans are digging their heels, despite Trump's and Witkoff's attempts to bring the war to an end. Now, I come to the conclusion that just as Putin and Medvedev, and to some extent Putin and Lavrov, play a game of soft cop, hard cop, Putin being the soft cop, Medvedev, Lavrov being the hard cop, though when you actually unscramble the substance, there really is no difference between them. So I'm starting to think that Medinsky is being set up as the hard cop dealing mostly with the Ukrainians, and Dmitriev is the soft cop dealing mainly with the Americans. Because again, I don't really see any major difference of substance between the two. When it comes to the actual realities of the situation, of the negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, I repeat the point that I have made already many times. The Russians talk about the spirit of Anchorage, the Anchorage concession. They talk about as if in Anchorage, Putin made some major concession to Witkoff and Trump, but there's never been any explanation of what that concession is. And given everything else that the Russians have been saying, which appears to be completely consistent with Putin's demands as set out in the Foreign Ministry on the 14th of June 2024, I don't get the sense that there has been any real Russian concession at all. I am starting to wonder whether the Russians themselves have been playing some sort of a game, talking up minor concessions on limited things, like perhaps the mechanics of a Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass and the monitoring of any cessation of hostilities whilst that retreat is taking place, whether they've talked that up in order to give both the Americans, at least specifically the Americans, the impression that they're being more flexible than they really are, and to highlight the complete intransigence of the Ukrainians. To repeat again, I'm hoping that Gordon Hahn and myself will have a proper discussion or conversation about all of this. He's, by the way, written another very fine piece on his Substack blog, continuing the discussion he's been having about me with me about whether or not the Russians really have watered down, or rather, not watered down, hardened their position. But anyway, I think the time has come for us to have a proper conversation, and I do stress a conversation, a discussion, talking about all of this and where these negotiations really are. But anyway, maybe not. We will be seeing at some point, maybe next week, though there's no sign yet of any agreement as to the date or venue or time, a further meeting between the Ukrainians, the Americans and the Russians. But to repeat again, the meeting that took place on Wednesday, or Tuesday and Wednesday, seems to have been a debacle with no progress at all being made. And we've had utterly scathing comments from the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, about the Europeans. He said that the Europeans who rushed to the Intercontinental Hotel in Geneva, purportedly at Zelensky's request, who wanting supposedly to gate crash the second day of the meeting, but firmly kept away by the Russians and the Americans from the meeting room. Anyway, the way Lavrov describes it, the Europeans spent most of their time in the Intercontinental Hotel, drinking coffee in the bars. I suspect that it was actually a lot more fraught and tense than that. But anyway, because of that bizarre circus that took place in Geneva, I wonder whether the Russians will say that perhaps a further meeting in Geneva, if there's going to be a meeting at all, Geneva is not perhaps the proper venue. Anyway, let's put it aside and wait to see what is happening. But there is no sign at all of any softening of the Russian position at the present time. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokesman has again reiterated that the Russians are not going to provide any information about what was actually discussed in the meeting rooms. The Russian Foreign Ministry has said that all parties agreed that there should be no leaks, which is a hopeless agreement with parties like the Americans and the Ukrainians. In fact, we've had from the Ukrainians lots of leaks, and they all tell us one thing, that the Ukrainians, Zelensky himself, were very unhappy by the way the meeting went. Now, that brings me back to Zelensky and the incredible statements, series of statements that he made, which I discussed yesterday. The unbelievable interviews that he has given with Piers Morgan and with Axios, littered with four-letter words. The extraordinary comment he made to the Ukrainian cabinet about a three-year war. And growing sense I'm getting that the mood in Ukraine is now becoming very dark. Now, there's been a whole series of interesting articles which have appeared suddenly in the British and American media. Two of them, interestingly, have been in the London Times. One is a description of the state of the Ukrainian army on the front lines. The article is full of the usual boilerplate about how the Russians are suffering catastrophic losses, the resilience and resolve of the Ukrainian military, the supposed success of the Starlink disconnection, which I think has been one of the most exaggerated stories of the entire war, by the way. But the article confirmed that the Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines are now increasingly few in number, that they are exhausted, that some of them have now developed extraordinary levels, very high levels of panic and fear, that many of them leave their positions, abandon their positions for days on end, even when they choose not to desert, because they can't bear the stress of being on the front lines for days and weeks on end. How many of these soldiers have been in action in one form or another since the start of the special military operation 4 years ago, and some of them longer still, extending all the way back to the fighting in the spring of 2014. And anyway, the overall picture was of a military that is desperately run down. And then the London Times followed it up with another extraordinary article. It said it acknowledged that Ukraine is short of every type of material that it needs to continue the war, that the Russians are superior in artillery, in drones, in armoured vehicles, in shells, you name it. The Russians now have a growing and already crushing preponderance on the battlefields. And the Russians also have a preponderance in numbers of infantry. The article said that Ukraine needs another 250,000 men to win the war. Now, there is no possibility of Ukraine achieving any sort of military victory in this war. That is simply not going to happen. And I have no doubt at all that the authors, or perhaps, shall we say, the sources, the people who provided the information for this article, know this perfectly well. When the article says that Ukraine needs 250,000 additional troops over and above the numbers that it has already, what it is saying is that the Ukrainian military is close to crisis, that it is reaching the point where it cannot sustain the war for much longer. Now, this article also has some of the usual boilerplate. It confirms, or at least it alleges that though the Russians have more infantry, more troops in every part of the conflict line, exactly as the operations chief of the Ukrainian general staff, of the Russian general staff, Sergei Rutskoy, said a few days ago, and are able to infiltrate behind Ukrainian positions. Anyway, the article in the London Times nonetheless said that the Russians are suffering these enormous losses, that they're only able to sustain the war for a further year, and the implication was that if Ukraine can somehow hold out for another year, things will get better. I'm not sure to what extent the sources behind this article believe this analysis. To repeat again, any information that these sources have about the situation in Russia seems to me to come mostly from Ukrainian sources and should not be taken as reliable. I'm being very polite here. The key thing is that the Ukrainian army is in a wasting condition. It's gradually thinning to the point where it simply can't hold. And this article in the London Times essentially admits this. And that brings me back to that article I discussed yesterday, the article about attrition, the article written by Mr. Powell, in which he has applied mathematical formulae that go back to the First World War, and the article in which he says that he believes that after about September of this year, we will start to see the Ukrainian military begin to collapse. The level, the ability to keep fighting, to maintain positions, to hold territory, will start to go. And that is the point where Russian breakthroughs might come, and we could see a cascade effect, and the effect of 4 years, well, 5 years of attrition by that point, will begin decisively to tell. Well, anyway, we have all of these articles, and what is Zelensky saying in the face of all of this? That Ukraine must go on fighting for a further 3 years, that it must not make any concessions whatsoever, that Ukraine cannot give up so much as a millimetre of ground, that it must not retreat from Donbass, that it must hold on to the 20% of Donetsk region that it still has, even though the Russians now are hammering at the door of Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, and are in the process of storming Konstantinovka. Well, I get to say it. I am wondering whether the point has now been reached where even in Ukraine itself, even among some of the more hardline figures in Ukraine, even on the part of those who continue to receive endless supplies of money from the West and who are, have supported Zelensky up to now because he ensures that the money continues to flow. I wonder whether even they, after comments of this kind, after those bizarre interviews that Zelensky gave to Piers Morgan and to Axios, might be starting to ask themselves whether Zelensky has so completely lost contact with reality that the moment has come to remove him, to try to find some other leader who might be in a better position to negotiate with the Russians to keep the war, to end the fighting, and to preserve Ukraine and their positions in Kiev, or if not that, at least to communicate with the Americans in a more rational and more reasonable way. And that brings me back to General Zaluzhny, the Ukrainian ambassador in London, who was formerly the military chief in Ukraine. He fell out with Zelensky in late 2023, early 2024, after the catastrophic failure of Ukraine's, well, catastrophic defeat of Ukraine's summer 2023 offensive in Zaporozhye. A couple of days ago, Zaluzhny also gave an interview, also, interestingly, to the London Times, in which he blamed Zelensky for the offensive of 2023 and for the disaster that took place there. He spoke about the incredible tensions between himself and Zelensky and Yermak. He spoke about how, at one point, shortly before he was dismissed by Zelensky, Zelensky and Yermak sent the SBU, Ukraine's counterintelligence service to raid and search Zaluzhny's own military headquarters, and how Zaluzhny himself countered by threatening Zelensky and Yermak with deployment of the Ukrainian army to Kiev, purportedly to protect Zaluzhny's headquarters. But of course, if that had happened, if Ukrainian military units had been transferred from the front line to Kiev itself, it would have been impossible to avoid the impression that some kind of coup was actually underway. And I have no doubt at all that this would probably have led not just to a political crisis, but at least to a coup attempt which might have failed or might have succeeded. Back in the late winter, early spring of 2024, Alex and I on the Duran discussed extensively the fact that there was apparently a power struggle underway between Zaluzhny and Zelensky. And we speculated at that time about the possibilities of a coup. So I remember did Larry Johnson on Sonar 21. There was an extraordinary incident where one of Zaluzhny's top lieutenants was killed by an exploding grenade, which had been supplied to him in a gift. We were told at the time that this was all a mistake, an idea which I consider preposterous, just to say. But anyway, it looks as if Zaluzhny is now appearing to confirm, that something did indeed happen in 2024 that does approximate very, very closely, from the way Zaluzhny describes it, to an actual coup attempt against Zelensky and Yermak. Even if it was they who took the first step by unleashing the SBU to raid Zaluzhny's headquarters, the very fact that they did that at all strongly suggests to me that they suspected, probably with good cause, that Zaluzhny was indeed engaged in preparations for a coup. Now, Zaluzhny bringing all this up again, after all this time, blaming Zelensky for the failure of the 2023 offensive, in which, by the way, Zaluzhny is being very unfair. Zaluzhny also played a role in that disastrous offensive. And of course, the major pressure for it came from the United States, from the Biden administration and the British, as I very well remember, but let's skip all of that. Anyway, I wonder whether Zaluzhny, by bringing all this up now, isn't once again hinting at the need for some action to remove Zelensky today. I suspect that the only reason, the main reason why Zelensky survived the crisis in 2024 was because the Americans and the Europeans, in the end, still confirmed that they were backing him, that they preferred him to Zaluzhny, not so much because they have any issue with Zaluzhny, but because they did not want to risk instability in Kiev, a crisis in Kiev, when the war was already beginning to turn bad. So perhaps now, 2 years later, when the situation is far worse than it was in 2024, when Ukraine has lost a whole string of cities, Pokrovsk, Mirnograd. By the way, just to mention, that article in the London Times that spoke about There's two articles in the London Times that spoke about the exhaustion of the Ukrainian military and the fact that the Ukrainian military still needs 250,000 men, continue to peddle the fantasy that there are still Ukrainian troops holding out in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, and that the Ukrainians still hold positions there. And they still speak about the fighting in Guliapolye, Guliapolye itself still having been in contention. Nobody I know who follows the situation, really follows the situation objectively, believes that anymore, just to say. But anyway, there it is. The reality is, as I said, that all of these places, Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, Selidovo, Kurakhovo, Vugledar, Siversk, all of these places, and you can think of others since then, Toretsk, have all fallen under Russian control. The Russians are pushing towards the Dnieper. We'll discuss that further in a moment. The Ukrainian cities are in blackout. There's been another massive Russian missile strike over the course of the last 24 hours. We will discuss that in a moment too. The situation is far worse now than it was in 2024. And perhaps, just possibly, what seemed a very desperate thing to do in 2024, and a very risky thing to do in 2024, engineering the removal of Zelensky. Today, perhaps in Washington, perhaps to more people in Kiev, perhaps even to a few people in the West, is starting to look, given Zelensky's increasingly outlandish behavior, is starting to look like something that they might want to contemplate properly. What I'm going to say about this is that I have actually lived through a coup. A coup took place in Greece, in Athens, in my childhood. I remember it well. I've followed coups in many places around the world. I have a fairly good sense when we are in a pre-coup situation in one particular country, in any particular country. I was one of those, for example, who in the early summer of 1999 said that in Russia a power struggle was clearly underway and that the then president, Boris Yeltsin, was likely to fall. I said this at the time. I discussed this in other programs. I'm not going to repeat this. I'm not going to go over this whole story again. All I will say is that I have a reasonable track record with this kind of thing and a certain experience. It does seem to me that Kiev today is starting to have something of the look about it, of a capital that is once more in a pre-coup situation. It may not be a coincidence that the corruption crisis, the investigation, has now been restarted, at least in some form, with the arrest and prosecution of Ukraine's former energy minister, who was supposedly arrested as he was trying to leave the country. If I am correct about this, then it could be that this crisis could escalate in Kiev over the next few weeks. And well, we will see how that plays out. Anyway, that's the political diplomatic situation. The military situation for Ukraine goes from bad to worse. Last night, we had another massive Russian combined missile and drone strike. And once again, it appeared to be primarily targeting the energy system, though No doubt other targets were also used, was also struck, and it was clear that the Russians used, again, this extraordinarily complex number of missiles that they now do. These strikes that the Russians conduct, I have to say, must require enormous levels of planning and organization, given the extraordinary array of different missiles, different types of drone. I mean, we may be talking, for example, about Garand drones, but Garand drones now come in all sorts of different shapes and sizes. They're Garand drones that are the old, simple turboprop drones that are suicide drones. There are others that are used for surveillance. There are others which are hunter-killer drones that attack and engage in air-to-air combat. Ukrainian drones that are also trying to shoot them down or shoot down other Garand drones. There are jet-powered Garand drones. And we now have other Garand drones that are able to carry and launch first-person view drones, FPV drones, which can also then hover around doing damage in Kiev or other cities. Drones that act as carriers for other drones as well. The Ukrainians, by the way, pioneered that type of drone. But now the Russians are also doing it, and of course they're doing it industrially. So there's this huge zoo, if you like, of Garand drones all being used. And there is a large number of different types of missiles that are being launched by the Russians at the same time. So the Russians launched KH-101 subsonic cruise missiles launched from their strategic bombers. Again, I'm not sure about the number, but there were certainly at least a score of these, perhaps more. Alongside them, the Russians also launched Tsarkon hypersonic cruise missiles launched from the territory of the Black Sea, probably from land-based launchers located in Crimea. There are different claims about the number of these Tsarkon cruise missiles that the Russians launched. Some say it was two. Others say it was as many as eight. I don't think the Ukrainians have any ability to intercept these Tsarkon missiles. The Russians also launched large numbers of Iskander ballistic missiles. Again, there's disputes about how many. The lowest number that I have seen is 15. Perhaps it was more. And for all we know, this is just the start of the strike. We've had even bigger strikes from the Russians in the past. In fact, much bigger strikes, even though this is a massive strike by any objective measure. And we could be getting more strikes using even more different types of missiles over the course of the next couple of hours. Now, as of the time of making of this programme, it's very difficult to say what damage exactly this strike has done. But it seems that the electricity substation located to the west of Kiev, the one which transfers electric power generated from Ukraine's nuclear power stations, it seems that this was also, that this was again a target. It looks like a thermal power station, which the Ukrainians had, up to a certain point at least, repaired and which had just come back on stream. We don't know to what degree. Anyway, it looks as if this was attacked and perhaps destroyed all over again, or damaged beyond repair, or damaged beyond early repair all over again. Odessa, it seems, was particularly badly hit. And Kiev also was attacked, and attacked very heavily. And again, I'm not sure what the exact result of all of these attacks was. Now, I've spoken about Zelensky's increasingly erratic, eccentric behavior, which even for some Ukrainians must be becoming increasingly frustrating. Amongst other things that Zelensky has been doing is that he has been trying to put pressure on Hungary and Slovakia by blocking oil to these two countries, Russian oil supplied to Hungary and Slovakia via the Druzhba oil pipeline built by the Soviet Union, which crosses Ukraine. And Zelensky has been doing all of this whilst entering into an extraordinary war of words with Orban and Fico. Orban, of course, faces elections in April, and one must assume that part of this is Zelensky's attempt to undermine Orban's position ahead of those elections. Orban and Fico, incidentally, received support from an unlikely source over the last few days, the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, after attending the Munich Security Conference, flew to Budapest and Bratislava, and he met there with Orban and Fico and appeared to endorse Orban ahead of the forthcoming elections. Anyway, the key thing here is that Hungary and Slovakia, Fico and Orban, have responded to all of this pressure from Zelensky and this war of words by saying, firstly, that they're going to oppose Zelensky's attempts to bring Ukraine on an expedited basis into the European Union. This is a complex and bizarre story, which I will discuss in a later programme, that they've just blocked the 90 billion euro loan to Ukraine, the one that was agreed in December, from progressing. I've discussed the many problems with this 90 billion euro loan in many programs already. It's a topic again for a further discussion. But most importantly and pressingly, they've also stopped exports to Ukraine of electricity and diesel oil. And Ukraine, with its electricity system now in crisis, absolutely does need whatever electricity it gets. And Hungary and Slovakia have been amongst the major providers of electric power to Ukraine from the European Union. So whatever Zelensky eventually achieves with Orban, and I can very easily see, by the way, how this might all backfire, and it might actually help Orban in the forthcoming elections, because at least he's standing up for Hungary against the combined pressure of the European Union and Ukraine, just saying. But anyway, the election is still weeks away. But in the meantime, even as the Russians are pounding and obliterating Ukraine's electricity and energy system. Zelensky seems to be determined to make Ukraine's electricity situation and energy situation even worse by engaging in this argument at this time, this quarrel at this time, with Orban and Fico, which has ended up with both sides each basically blockading the flow of energy to each other. Hungary will never completely be without energy. The same is true of Slovakia. The cutoff of oil is undoubtedly going to create severe difficulties for these two countries. But there is a difference between severe difficulties and an existential situation, and that is what Ukraine is now facing. Zelensky, however, once again, is letting his emotions spiral out of control. He seems to be more interested in doing harm to Orban and Fico than in looking after the interests of his own country. Meanwhile, the situation on the front lines continues to deteriorate. And again, there is a lot of stories being spread about this, especially in the Western media, which again, people are being over-influenced by. This is my own view about the situation on the front lines being in stalemate. It isn't. The Russian forces conducting operations in eastern Zaporozhye region, pushing towards Orekhov and ultimately the city of Zaporozhye, and the Dnieper, are saying that we should all be ready for some important and positive news. Important and positive from a Russian point of view. That suggests that this line of villages that lies between this Russian group of forces and the main supply road to Orekhov has now been penetrated, and perhaps some of these villages are about to fall. Just saying. And, well, the reports also continue to speak of further Russian advances in Konstantinovka. The fact that we're getting less information, we've had less information from Konstantinovka over the last 24 hours, I take as a sign of significant Russian advances in Konstantinovka. That is what tends to happen, by the way, before the Russians announce big breakthroughs in places like Konstantinovka. And perhaps even more importantly, around the cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, territory which has been opened up to the Russians since the fall of Siversk, the Russian advance seems to be very rapid, and the Russians now do seem to be approaching the important village, the important fortified position of Rai Alexandrovka, east of Kramatorsk, and they also seem to be rapidly clearing the Ukrainians from a range of hills that lies between Siversk and Slavyansk, a situation where all of the various Russian units operating this area, all the front lines, will join up, sealing the fate of Liman and opening the way to both Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. I am certain that the events in 2026 in the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk area and in Zaporozhye are going to move much faster than many people imagine. The mystery for me, the uncertainty, does not relate to these regions. It relates to the fact that the Russians are systematically capturing villages along the Russian-Ukrainian border in Sumy, Kharkiv, and I believe even Chernigov regions. I am not sure why. Some people are talking about this being a buffer zone. To me, this increasingly looks like the Russians establishing launch positions for advances to the main towns in this area, Sumy, Kharkiv, Chernigov, ultimately Kiev itself. I wonder whether this isn't preparation for the 2027 campaign in the north, once Donbass and Zaporozhye have been cleared and the Dnieper has been reached, just to say. Anyway, there it is. That is the situation on the front lines. It is also, as I said, my sense that in Kiev itself, we might be moving away from this rather strange period that started in the spring of 2024 and which lasted until this summer, when it looked to me as if Zelensky's position had become completely secure. Today, on the contrary, it looks as if his position is slipping again, and perhaps his decision to appoint Poklad, General Poklad, to take over operational control of the SBU also points in that direction. Meanwhile, the Russians have been talking about other things. The FSB, Russia's counterintelligence agency, has said that a third party was involved in the assassination attempt on General Alexeyev, the head of Russian military intelligence, which took place about 2 weeks ago. Now, when the Russians talk about a third party, they don't mean Ukraine. They consider Ukraine to have been the other party, the direct party involved in this assassination attempt. When they talk about a third party, they mean the intelligence agencies of some Western country. And they made it fairly clear again that the country that they identify as being responsible for this assassination attempt was Britain. I get to say straight away that I am not certain about this. I'm not saying that the British don't do these things, and I am not saying that the British don't have an extraordinary fervour in terms of support for Ukraine, which troubles me, concerns me immensely. Probably the British are involved to some extent in the dirty war, perhaps to a great extent. But I do have to make this point. Whenever we get revelations about the dirty war, the assassination attempts that the Ukrainians commit inside Russia, the bombing, the sabotage, all of these things, the drone attacks on Russian positions and on Russian industrial and economic facilities inside Russia. Whenever we get information about this and confirmation in the West that it is happening, and confirmation of Western involvement, it is always American involvement rather than British which is confirmed. It is always the CIA, not MI6. We've even had this recently with that article in Der Spiegel about the blowing up of the Nord Stream pipelines. As I discussed in yesterday's programme, Der Spiegel now acknowledges that the Americans had some involvement in that operation, even though, according to Der Spiegel, they eventually pulled out. I've already, by the way, said that in my opinion, most of that article is BS, just to say. But regardless of that, Der Spiegel now finally says, yes, the Americans at some level were indeed involved. They knew what the Ukrainians were planning. They were involved. They might have changed their minds and said no, but not until after they had previously said yes. So, given that the Americans, it is the Americans, the CIA, that is acknowledged to have been involved in the dirty war, given that it is the CIA that has immeasurably greater resources than MI6 does, why assume if a Western intelligence agency is involved in some further dirty war event inside Russia, like the assassination attempt on General Alexeyev? Why assume it is Britain and not the CIA? After all, the CIA has an actual, verified, corroborated, admitted track record here. I'm starting to wonder whether the Russians aren't using some sort of code here. Whether when they say the British, they actually mean the Americans. All the more so, as to my knowledge, the Russians, in terms of intelligence, to a great extent, conflate the two. They see MI6 as basically a cat's paw for the CIA, just as they see the British signals gathering agency, GCHQ, as basically a big outstation doing work for the Americans as well. Anyway, I just float that out. I just mentioned this. What is true in Britain is that our economic position, despite some heroic attempts to pretend otherwise, continues to go from bad to worse. And this morning, there was a fascinating article in The Guardian. For a short time, it was the lead story, and it confirms that the Confederation of British Industry, the biggest business organisation in Britain, and Energy UK have written what is described as a stinging letter to the British government, saying that a proximate cause of Britain's economic problems are the sky-high energy prices that we have in Britain. And, well, I read the article with interest, and it reads as follows. The first few chapters, the first few paragraphs lead as follows. The UK is at risk of losing its status as a major manufacturing centre after a sharp rise in energy prices that have forced about 40% of businesses to cut back investment, according to a report by the CBI and Energy UK. In a stinging message to ministers, the report said British businesses, from chemical producers to pubs and restaurants, were being undermined by a failure to cap, that's to say, to control prices and upgrade the UK's ageing gas and electricity networks. A far-reaching review of outmoded regulations that govern the sale and supply of energy is also needed to spur investment and boost economic growth, the report said. Energy UK, which represents more than 100 electricity generators and retailers, said business electricity costs remained 70% higher than before Russia's invasion of Ukraine, while gas prices were 60% higher. It is the last paragraph that leaves me gasping. So what we're told is that electricity costs since Britain and the European Union started to impose sanctions on Russia, banned imports into the European area of Russian gas, oil, all of those sort of things, coal also, by the way, that since that happened, electricity prices in Britain have increased by 70%, and gas prices have increased by 60%. And this is turning out to be a body blow to British manufacturing, that British manufacturing is now at risk, that if this continues for much longer, British manufacturing industry might have to basically shut down, and that even retail outlets like pubs and restaurants are affected. Now, who would have ever thought that? Who would have ever thought that something like that began to happen in February 2022, when the special military operation began, and when the British, the Europeans, and the Americans started to unroll their great sanctions war against Russia? Well, we thought it. We thought about it on the Duran. Alex and I talked about this at the time. We have spoken about it extensively since. We have mostly focused on Germany, admittedly, where there is a mounting deindustrialization crisis, which gets worse and worse and worse. But we see that Britain is also catastrophically affected, that British manufacturing is in decline. We're going through, at the moment in Britain, another one of those periodic stages when everybody's talking about the need to reindustrialize Britain. The CBI and Energy UK saying that this is impossible, that energy costs are too high, electricity is too high, gas is too high, and this is putting the whole manufacturing, the existing manufacturing situation in Britain in jeopardy. Let's just not even think about returning to being a manufacturing economy again, because that is impossible. But consider the rest of the article. The only place in this whole article, I've only read from a small part of it, where the fact that electricity prices have increased by 70% and gas prices have increased by 60% since February 2022. The only place where that is mentioned is in that one paragraph. And it is reported there as if this is somehow one of those things that just happens, that after the Russians decided, for no seeming reason, presumably, to invade Ukraine. Notice they always talk about the invasion of Ukraine. Well, directly after that, prices went up. And we're told that business electricity costs remain 70% higher than before Russia's invasion of Ukraine, while gas prices were 60% higher. There is no apparent connection made between the two. There is no cause and effect. There is a total refusal, on the contrary, to admit that the sanctions, the economic blockade, or rather the economic war against the Russians might have anything to do with this. That the reason that pubs and restaurants, which provided such an important part of British life, might be closing is because we are taking on an economic adversary who is far mightier than ourselves. In Responsible Statecraft, there is an article by Mark Episkopos, who has just been to Moscow, and he has talked about the appearance of normality, the state of economic normality that you see in Moscow at the present time. There is no economic normality currently in Britain. And you could see the proximate cause as to why that is. There is no open, honest discussion about this matter in Britain, just as there isn't any honest discussion, properly speaking, in most of Europe. The AfD in Germany talk about it, at least to some extent, but in Britain, none of the contending political parties, not even the opposition ones, the Greens and Reform, talk about it to any extent either. Germany has, as discussed many times, done colossal damage to itself. There are many economic commentators in Germany itself who talk about Germany committing economic suicide, or at least industrial suicide. I'm not pushing back against that. I think that is true to a great extent. But surely, if we're talking about industrial suicide, economic suicide, it's even truer of my own country, of Britain. But nobody talks about changing course. On the contrary, Britain's Defence Secretary, John Healey, is now coming out and saying that he looks forward to being the first British Defence Secretary to send to deploy British troops to Ukraine. He still says that he wants to do that after a ceasefire is agreed. He's totally oblivious to the fact, or rather, he doesn't want to address the fact that the Russians are saying that such an action is unacceptable and that they will consider the British troops, if they ever go to Ukraine, to be legitimate targets. Nor does John Healey admit the dire state of the British armed forces. There's a long article about this very topic in The Spectator. It talks about how completely hollowed out the British military has now become, how Russia has 5,000 tanks, Britain has perhaps 180. I believe, by the way, that only 40 of those are operational. How Russia has 540 fighter jets, Britain has 68, and not all of those are operational either. But, you know, John Healey doesn't want to talk about any of that. And incredibly, as the British Labour Party thrashes around searching for someone to take Keir Starmer's place, we know Keir Starmer is discredited. There's going to be an important parliamentary by-election on Thursday next week, which Labour is universally expected to lose, and lose badly, and many believe that that will trigger further pressure on Starmer to step down. But believe it or not, in the absence of any viable alternative, there are now some people within the Labour Party who are saying, well, maybe, just possibly, the right man to take over is in fact John Healey, the British Defence Secretary, the person who wants to continue the conflict with Russia, who wants to take this disastrous, reckless step of sending British troops to Ukraine? What is it that has been said? Those whom the gods destroy, they first make mad. If we're talking about the British political class, it seems to me they've all gone mad. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. Don't forget also that you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.